Well, tonight we continue our series on church history, and we're in the middle of this section on the Arian controversy, the heresy of Arianism, and it's in the 4th century AD, in the 300s AD. So just to recap a bit of where we've been, kind of leading up to this present story of history. History is a story that played out under God's providence. And you remember, the Arian controversy is all the question about who is Christ? Who is Christ? Many of you are familiar with Matthew 16:16. After Jesus asked, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And the question becomes, though, what do we mean by Son? Arius, you remember, he was an individual that lived in Alexandria in the early 300s. And he said that Jesus Christ is the first created being, that he's a mere creature. He was removed by a local council led by Alexander as bishop of Alexandria. Arius proposed his beliefs in 318. He was removed by 320 AD, 2 years later. It's a key period of time because you remember Constantine, the emperor of the West. There were two emperors at that time of Constantine in 312 AD, one over the East, one over the West. He was over the West, part of the Roman Empire. And he was brought to faith in a dream at the Milvian Bridge, for the Milvian Bridge battle. He had a dream the night before where he saw the two first Greek letters of Christ's name, the Chi Rho sign, in the shape of a cross. And he either heard or saw the words, "In this sign you will conquer." So he had the next morning that sign put on the shields of his troops. And with a smaller force, he won. He became a Christian in 312. Well, he had made an agreement with the emperor of the East, who was a pagan, to tolerate both paganism and Christianity. Eventually, the pagan reneged on that, the pagan emperor of the East, and began persecuting Christians in the East. So Constantine, as a Christian, waged what he regarded as a holy war against that emperor. Defeated him in 324 AD and became the emperor of the entire Roman Empire. But he found a great controversy taking place then, because Arius had proposed his view that Jesus was just a creature, the firstborn creature, but merely a creature. Proposed that in 318. He was removed by the bishop of Alexandria, whose name was Alexander, who held a local council in 320. And this is where Arius left, and he went to Palestine, went north to Palestine, and in that area, trying to get people to support his views. He didn't go away quietly into the night, and that's where, in 324, when Constantine gained control of the entire Roman Empire, by winning and defeating the Eastern Emperor, he ran into this great controversy in 324. And the emperors had the imperial power, which always meant being in charge of whatever the religion was. So he thought nothing of it. He says, "My role is to bring about peace in the church." So he called the Nicene Council together, the first ecumenical council of the Catholic Church in 325. AD, to solve this issue. We had looked at that. Alexander was there. He had his secretary and a leading deacon with him, whose name was Athanasius, who later became the bishop of Alexandria in 328 AD. For 45 years, Athanasius was the bishop of Alexandria. Alexandria was the stronghold of Nicene thinking in the East, in the Eastern Empire. Well, the Nicene Creed had sayings in it that essentially said that Christ was God from God, light from light, and the key phrase was begotten, not created, of the same essence as the Father, homoousios in Greek, homoousios, of the same essence as the Father. They had anathemas in the Nicene Creed. Anathemas are curses, and giving people over to Satan if you don't sign the creed. Arius and two others did not sign it, so Constantine banished them. But what happened was really three parties formed in the East. And there were followers of Arius. It was a small group. Followers of the Nicene is what eventually developed, a small group. And the largest group was Origenists, the followers of Origen, who believed that Jesus was the only begotten, eternal Son of God, divine, but just a little less divine than the Father. Even though they had signed the Nicene Creed, that was their view. And that was the majority in the East. These three groups were in the East. In the West, it was all basically Nicene, Bible-believing Nicene Christians. Constantine died in 337 AD. Once Constantine died, the empire was again divided into two between his two sons, Constans and Constantius. Constans in the West was Nicene. Constantius in the East had Arian leanings, and he was controlled by Arians. That was 337. He exiles Athanasius. Athanasius had been bishop since 328. Constantine died 337, goes to his two sons. Constantius is Arian in the East. He's then exiling in the East Athanasius and another bishop. They flee to Rome. The Pope at the time in Rome evaluated their case and said their exile, that it was wrong. Well, the Origenists in the East looked and said, hey, you as the Pope of Rome have no authority to say that. They were challenging the authority of the Pope at that time. But they responded, the Origenists, in 341 AD with their own creed. And we looked at that, where they used homoiousios. They added an I in the middle. And that Greek word, homoiousios, means similar. Similar. Where in the Nicene Creed was homoousios, of the same essence. Where the Origenists, in their Creed 341, said homoiousios, similar, not same. And what had happened was roughly 50 years then of disagreement about who Christ was, and there was some misunderstandings based on language, where the Origenists were falsely thought of as Arians, because many times they would say he's inferior, because they thought he was less divine, the Son, Christ. But because they kept saying he was inferior, many of the Nicenes looked and said, well, you must be Arian. So they were thinking many of the Origenists were Arians because they were saying inferior, so inferior they were stressing that it must be just a created being. So many of them were falsely thought of as Arians, many of the Origenists. But many of the Origenists falsely thought that the Nicenes were Sabellian. And that's that form of modalism, because the Nicenes focus so much on one essence. God is of one essence. And if he's one singular, one essence, homoousios, then Father and Son must be just the appearance of it, not really two persons, but just the appearance of it. That was the heresy of Sabellianism, modalism, just as a mode, just one person, one essence, and just appears to be a Father, appears to be a Son at certain times, but really not. So they had misunderstandings, and the Arians pitted them against each other. The Arians pitted the Origenists and the Nicenes against one another for 50 years, roughly. And we're going to see it tonight, where finally they got resolved in the Council of Constantinople in 381 A.D. Okay. 341, the Origenists had their own homoiosis, similar creed. And things had calmed down somewhat after that dispute. Athanasius did return back to Alexandria from Rome. But then a significant event happened in 350 AD. Constans was murdered by a rebel Roman general in the West. Constans was a good emperor. He was a Nicene emperor, a biblical one who said Jesus is truly divine, of the same essence with the Father. But he was murdered by a rebel Roman general in 350. 3 years later, 353 AD, Constantius wages war against that Roman general and defeats him in 353 AD. So in 353 AD, and this is where we ended last time, Constantius has power over the whole thing, the whole Roman Empire. So he's been doing his thing, persecuting the Nicenes, because he's Arian. He's been persecuting the Nicenes in the East. So right after he got to power, after Constantine's death, his father's death in 337, he exiled Athanasius and another bishop, and then they fled to Rome. So he's been doing his thing, persecuting the Nicenes in the East, but by 353, he's in charge of all of it. So now he's going to turn his guns to the West, you see, and begin by 356, exiling those in the West within 3 years of controlling the entire empire, but he's focusing on those in the West then, because now he controls the West. Okay? Make sense, everybody? Tonight we're looking then from Constantius to the Council of Constantinople, particularly when he defeated that rebel Roman general in 353 AD to Constantinople 381 AD. So in this roughly 30-year span is what we're looking at tonight. In matters of theology, Constantius was ruled by a group of Arian bishops. He had Arian leanings, but you could say, as Nick Needham does, the church historian, he was really ruled by a group of Arian bishops. Constantius, once he's in control of the entire Roman Empire, now it's his first time in control of the West, that had all been Nicene. He sent into exile any bishop or presbyter who would not submit to Arianism, and his most famous victim in the West, in Western France, was Hilary of Poitiers. Hilary of Poitiers lived 315 to 368 AD. He was a bishop of Western France, and he was banished to Asia Minor. So he's like, he sent him over to where there's a lot less Nicenes, and banished him in Asia Minor in 356 AD, 3 years after Constantius got control of the entire Roman Empire. Interestingly, while in exile in Asia Minor, Hilary wrote his influential treatise on the Trinity. On the Trinity. Hilary is sometimes referred to as the Athanasius of the West, being from Western France, and having written his treatise on the Trinity. And this is where you have the defense of the deity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, of all three persons, of being of one essence. Hilary of Poitiers is the first of the great Latin hymn writers. Remember, Latin was dominant in the West. Again, there's an imaginary line between Italy and Greece, going north-south. So just east of Italy, just west of Greece, an imaginary line going north-south, that was kind of the line of what was west Roman Empire, what was east Roman Empire, and east was more Greek language, and west was Latin, especially among the scholars. Constantius also exiled the Nicene Pope at the time, the Pope at Rome, Liberius, also in 356 AD. Constantius also exiled, and in this sense he exiled in imprisoning them, the Pope and Hosius, and torturing them. But Constantine's old counselor, Hosius of Cordova, remember when Constantine then became a Christian after the battle at Milvian Bridge, he chooses this bishop in Spain, Hosius of Cordova, to be his counselor. And he gave him wise counsel, biblical counsel on reforming laws, the morals of their society. That's where he had maintenance grants for parents to try and help them out. He tried to prevent the killing of unwanted children. He tried to end the gladiator games because of the ruthless violence and death and killing. He outlawed crucifixion as a form of punishment. It's cruel and unusual. He outlawed the branding of criminals on the forehead, saying we're created in the image of God. We shouldn't have our foreheads branded, even if we're criminals. He was trying to reform morals. But Hosius of Cordova, this bishop, was Constantine's old Christian advisor. At this point, he was 100 years old. 100 years old in 356 AD. He will die in 357, 1 year later. But he's imprisoned, he is tortured, along with the Nicene Pope. Hosius was a staunch Nicene. Well, they were tortured, and under torture, they both signed an Arian statement. But Hosius of Cordova renounced it on his deathbed in 357 AD, a year later. He renounced it and said, I'm not an Arian. I believe Jesus Christ is of the same essence of the Father, truly divine. Also in 356 AD, so he had exiled Hilary of Poitiers, exiled the Pope of Rome, exiled Hosius of Cordova. He's torturing them. Constantius banished Athanasius again in 356 AD, where he had returned temporarily back to Alexandria. Well, he's exiled again. And Constantius had sent troops down to Alexandria to arrest him. You know, before, Constantius was only over the east. Right? When Constantine died, 337, two sons. Constans, the Nicene, got the west part of the empire, Constantius the east. So then Athanasius could flee to the west. And he fled to Rome. We're here, what do? Constantius, the Arian's over the whole darn thing. So he fled into the desert, and he lived for 6 years among the Egyptian monks, where we went through monasteries and how they began with the Egyptian monks. That's where he fled and lived with them for 6 years in the desert. Remember, for basically 45 years as bishop of Alexandria, Athanasius was exiled 17 years out of the 45 years. Basically a third of his time as the bishop of Alexandria, he was exiled. But he was a staunch defender of the Nicene Creed and biblical view that Jesus is truly divine. And remember, Nicodemus said Athanasius was one of the greatest theologians in the history of the church. It's quite a thing to say. At the heart of his theology was salvation, and how we are saved through a divine redeemer. That was huge for Athanasius. Well, Constantius's troops, just I put one example here. Constantius's troops were so brutal. At one point, they built a big fire down in Alexandria, and they told the virgins, there were women there that were virgins, not married, and said, we're going to throw you in the fire unless you embrace Arianism. If you refuse Arianism, we'll throw you into the fire. Well, the virgin Christians refused Arianism. And what the soldiers did is stripped them naked and then beat their faces to a pulp. By 360 AD, Constantius forced most of the East and of the West into Arianism. By 360. He got control over the West in 353. In 7 years, through lethal, deadly force and torture, he forced basically all the West, as well as the East, into Arianism. Many Originists, those who followed the teaching of Origen in the East, were also exiled with the Nicene. They weren't Arian. Remember, the Originists followed Origen. Origen, remember, was of Alexandria, died in 253. 100 years earlier, because of wounds from being tortured himself for his beliefs as a Christian under persecution. He was real good on saying Jesus was the only begotten Son, eternal only begotten Son, but he had other problems. And one of the problems was saying that there were degrees of divinity, which was more of a pagan idea, that Jesus was the eternal only begotten Son, he's divine, but a little less than the Father. So that was his problem. But those that followed Origen on that were also persecuted in the East with the Nicenes. The most famous Originist victim was Cyril of Jerusalem, and another was Basil of Ancyra. What's interesting is you always have the law of unintended consequences in public policy. The law of unintended consequences. And the unintended consequences of the Arians persecuting the Originists is many of them begin to look at Nicene theology as more favorable. Kind of an unintended consequence of, well, we're being persecuted with them. What's their deal? Let's look closely at the Nicenes. And some of them then became Nicenes. I looked at it closer, and many Originists converted to Nicene theology. Cyril of Jerusalem was one of them that eventually joined the Nicene party. Constantius died in 361 AD, 8 years after he got control of the entire empire. And he forced Arianism on the whole empire. The new emperor was Julian the Apostate. Again, we've covered some of these things already from a different angle, the church-state relations, for instance. Well, Julian the Apostate gets control of the entire empire. He was one who was raised a Christian. He's referred to as the Apostate because he was raised a Christian but rejected Christianity. He abandoned it for Neoplatonism. Remember, as emperor, Julian the Apostate reopened the pagan temples and reallowed pagan sacrifices. So he was trying to bring the empire back to paganism. He himself embraced Neoplatonism, which we have looked at already, the basics of that, but that had gradations of reality, and it was a form of religion formed from Plato's philosophy. But that's what he had embraced himself, but he tried to bring the empire back to paganism. He only lived for 2 years here as emperor, and God removed him in 363. Interestingly, this is another fascinating thing of history, is Julian the Apostate said, you know, I'm going to let these exiled Nicenes and Originists come back, and I think it'll create great confusion. That was his goal, to create confusion. Let them come back, and they'll all be confused what's going on here. But Athanasius returned back to Alexandria then as a hero, and he did something that Julian the Apostate didn't expect, is Athanasius looked to the Originists and said, I'm a Nicene, but Originists, we're close, and we need to unite against Arianism. And that's the way Athanasius approached the Origenists. Say, you believe he's the only begotten eternal Son, God, truly God. We believe he's the only begotten eternal Son, truly God. The Origenists happen to say that he's a little inferior, but yet truly God, with all divine attributes, just a little inferior. And Athanasius took the approach that said, you know what? We've got to unite. Origenists and the Nicenes must both fight together against Arianism. Well, Julian the Apostate didn't like that, and he sent Athanasius again into exile. And as I mentioned, Julian the Apostate was killed fighting the Persians in 363 AD. So he was trying to bring the Roman Empire back to paganism and was unsuccessful. God didn't permit him to have time to do it. In 364 AD, Valentinian became emperor, and he went back to one emperor over the west and one emperor over the east. Valentinian placed his brother, Valens, over the east. His brother, Valens, was an Arian. Well, Valens began persecuting then both Origenists and Nicenes, and it ended up, the law of unintended consequences, it brought them together to fight Arianism, with Valens being an Arian, and he's persecuting both the Origenists and the Nicenes, then it brought them together. And that's what Athanasius wanted, was a united front against Arianism. When Julian the Apostate permitted them to come back, hoping to create confusion, remember, Athanasius came back to Alexandria. He was a hero. Well, Valens exiled him again. As many times happened, they would try persecution. It didn't work, so they'd stop. And Valens eventually stopped his persecution. So Athanasius returned to Alexandria in 366 AD. And Athanasius was bishop there for 6 more years, is the way Nick Needham describes it. So however the dates match, but you think, well, doesn't it add up to 7? But he states it as 6. Athanasius then served 6 more years as bishop of Alexandria and then died in 373 AD. Now, you say, okay, when one dies, who's going to carry the torch? Who's going to carry the torch? Who's going to carry the... He was the champion of Nicene theology, Athanasius. So who's going to carry the torch? And it ended up being what's known as the Cappadocian Fathers. The Cappadocian Fathers. They were contemporaries of Athanasius. So there were 3 of them. Basil of Caesarea, Gregory of Nyssa, and Gregory of Nazianzus. Basil of Caesarea lived 330 to 379 AD. And his brother, Gregory of Nyssa, lived 335 to 394 AD. Gregory of Nyssa was just 5 years younger, but a younger brother. But notice, Gregory of Nazianzus was born the same year as Basil of Caesarea, 330 AD. Gregory of Nazianzus lived 330 to 390 AD. Athanasius became bishop of Alexandria in 328. So 2 years after Athanasius became bishop, 2 of the Cappadocians were born. Basil of Caesarea and Gregory of Nazianzus. And those 2 were best of friends, just like David and Jonathan. 1 Samuel 18:1, 2 Samuel 1:26, the loyalty and the friendship between David and Jonathan is the same between Basil of Caesarea and Gregory of Nazianzus. They were born the same year, 330 AD. Now, I've included a quote here by Nick Needham. I thought it was interesting that Basil of Caesarea and his best friend and theologian with him in the fight for the Nicene theology, Gregory of Nazianzus. Basil of Caesarea and Gregory of Nazianzus both studied, Nick Needham puts this, both studied, quote, the riches of pagan culture and philosophy in Athens, the cradle of European thought, but without wandering in the slightest from their Christian beliefs and commitment, unquote. Read it again. So Basil of Caesarea and Gregory of Nazianzus, two of the Cappadocian fathers, best friends, they both studied, quote, the riches of pagan culture and philosophy in Athens, the cradle of European thought, but without wandering in the slightest from their Christian beliefs and commitment, unquote. Why do I put that in there? How many of you regard pagan culture and philosophy in Athens as riches? Do you embrace a monastery mindset? You want to go live out in the desert with the Egyptian monks and say there's nothing we can learn at all from the pagans? Remember, philosophy at that time, to a great extent, especially among the pre-Socratics in Athens, were scientists. It was natural philosophy. It meant being a scientist. Mathematically studying the world. And this is where we as Christians believe in common grace and general revelation. As well, Nick Needham points out that both of them, Basil of Caesarea and Gregory of Nazianzus, were baptized in 358 AD at the age of 28 as adults, even though they were both raised as Christians. No paedo baptism. No baptism as infants. Now remember, this coincides. We went through their view of baptism at that time, that dominated at that time. And remember, Constantine waited until the very end of his life to be baptized because the idea was you'd only be forgiven of sins you committed before baptism. So the idea was to wait. Well, but this is a practice. They were 28 years old when they were baptized. But as believers, as adults, Basil of Caesarea wrote On the Holy Spirit in 375 AD, arguing for the Holy Spirit's true and full deity, that the Holy Spirit is of the same essence as the Father and the Son. We're going to see as well, Athanasius wrote in 358 on the deity of the Holy Spirit. Basil's sermons in Greek are some of the clearest and beautiful in the patristic age, Nick Needham points out. Patristic age, remember, goes up to about 600 AD. Basil of Caesarea contributed as well to Eastern liturgy and Eastern monasticism. Notice, he only lived to be 49 years old, Basil of Caesarea. Gregory of Nazianzus, his good friend and theologian, wrote 5 theological orations summing up the Nicene doctrine of the Trinity. And he as well refuted Arianism in his treatise, the 5 theological orations. In the Eastern Church, Gregory of Nazianzus received the title Gregory the Theologian. Gregory the Theologian. Gregory of Nyssa, the brother of Basil of Caesarea, the younger brother, was so admired for his Nicene theology that he was asked to give the opening address at the Council of Constantinople in 381. Now, Gregory of Nyssa's main failure, everybody has flat spots, his main failure was accepting Origen's view of universal salvation. All 3 of the Cappadocian fathers admired Origen of Alexandria, who lived 100 years before them and died 253 AD. But Basil of Caesarea and Gregory of Nazianzus rejected Origen's universalism. As well, Basil of Caesarea rejected Origen's allegorical method of interpretation. You remember, Origen placed greater meaning and significance to the allegory of a text of the Bible rather than the literal meaning. So Basil of Caesarea really had it together. Rejected Origen's universalism, rejected the allegorical interpretation, as well embraced Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, all of the same essence, the full divinity of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Interestingly, it's the Cappadocian Fathers then that helped bring about a final union of Nicene and Originist parties. How did they do it? And this is what's leading up then to the Council of Constantinople in 381. But they're persuading both sides to use new theological language. Pastor Ron and I stress a lot that everything proceeds by definitions. You've got to get your definitions right, which is why the catechism we go through is so good. To get the biblical definitions of terms and words. The Nicenes and the Originists were using the same two words in Greek, hypostasis and ousia, to mean different things. We saw it as well with Sabellianism. Sabellianism used the word ousia for persons rather than for essence. So it's to get your terms right. We only have a meeting of the minds when we define our terms and understand them the same. So the words we use means the same thing in my mind as it means in your mind. Well, the Cappadocians, led by Basil, made two proposals to try and bring about the union of Originists and Nicenes. The word ousia should from now on refer to the one divine nature or essence, as the Nicenes said in 325 in the Nicene Creed. The word ousia in Greek should refer to the one divine nature or essence, which is what the Nicenes meant it to be in the Nicene Creed in 325. But the word hypostasis should refer specifically to two distinct persons of the Father and Son, as the Originists said. And they also settled the matter and dispute regarding the Holy Spirit. There was a group called the Macedonians. Macedonians that accepted the deity of Christ but denied the deity of the Holy Spirit. This is where, when we study church history, there's nothing new under the sun eventually with all of the weird, crazy views that are out there in our day. You can find them somewhere in church history. So they settled that dispute and saying, no, the Holy Spirit is truly divine as well. Athanasius, as I mentioned, had already argued in 358 AD that the Holy Spirit must be recognized as God alongside the Father and the Son. You think of Acts chapter 5, verses 3 and 4. Ananias and Sapphira sinned against the Holy Spirit, sinned against God when they lied about what they gave to the church after selling their property. Good text on the deity of the Holy Spirit, Acts 5, verses 3 and 4. And then Basil of Caesarea wrote his on the Holy Spirit in 375. So they were defending the deity of the Holy Spirit along the way. The Cappadocians then extended the term homoousios, of the same essence, that ousios should mean essence or nature, being or substance, the underlying deep reality of something, of an object. What is the deepest underlying innermost reality of an object? That's the ousia, the essence of something. And the Cappadocians extended that term homo, of the same, homo same, ousia, essence, homo ousios, to the Holy Spirit. So he too was of the same essence as the Father. Homo ousios. So amazingly, what began as a dispute about Christ with Arius in 318. And remember, there was another one, Lucian of Antioch, that died in 312 AD, but he was some regard as the father of Arianism, but he also taught that view that Jesus was just created. But what began in the early 300s is the dispute about Christ. Is he just created, or is he truly God in the flesh? That dispute ended with a full declaration of the doctrine of the Trinity. God is three hypostases in one ousia, in the Greek language. God is three persons, three hypostases, existing eternally in one single being or nature, one ousia. Now, I want to stress that's not a contradiction. We say that about in the Trinity, that God is three persons in one essence. Three persons in one essence. Remember, the law of non-contradiction says something cannot be what it is and not what it is, either at the same time or in the same relationship. So something cannot be both A and non-A at the same time or in the same relationship. Good cannot be both good and evil at the same time or in the same relationship. Well, here we have three persons in one essence. Three of A, one of B. It's not a contradiction. If you said three of A and one of A, that's a contradiction. Three persons in one person, that's a contradiction. Or one nature and three natures, that's a contradiction. But it's three persons in one nature. It's a mystery, but it's not a contradiction. Arius, if you remember back, last time we met, it's one of the main reasons he embraced his view, because he said, if you tell me that the Father is truly God, and that the Son is truly God, then there must be two gods. That's why he said, well, then the Son must just be created. Best creation, the first creation, but just created. And remember, Alexander, the bishop of Alexandria, did not come to that conclusion. He came to the Nicene, the biblical conclusion that says, no, Father can be truly God, Son can be truly God. That does not mean there's two gods. They can have two persons in one essence. It's not like us. For each of us, we have one person in one essence. And that was the trouble of Arian, is he was thinking of God in human terms. So, as three distinct persons, each one possesses the divine nature in a different way. This is a quote from Nick Needham. The Father possesses the divine nature in and of himself alone. The Son possesses the divine nature from the Father as a child from a parent by way of begetting or eternal generation. The Holy Spirit possesses the divine nature from the Father by proceeding from him, as stated in John 14, verse 26, as the everlasting breath of his mouth. Unquote. Read it again. As three distinct persons, each one possesses the divine nature in a different way. They're each unique persons. The Father possesses the divine nature in and of himself alone. The Son possesses the divine nature from the Father as a child from a parent by way of begetting or eternal generation. The Holy Spirit possesses the divine nature from the Father by proceeding from him, John 14:26, as the everlasting breath of his mouth. Unquote. Origenus gave up saying the Son was inferior, and the Nicenes distanced themselves then conclusively from the Sabellian heresy of modalism. To make it absolutely clear, we have three hypostases, three persons in one nature. Rather than the Sabellians would say one person in one nature appearing to be three different persons at different times, but not really. The Arian Emperor Valens, he died fighting the Goths in 378. Remember, after Julian the Apostate died 363, then Valentian became emperor, appointed his brother Valens in 364, and here he is dead by, Valens is dead by 378 fighting the Goths. The West had a Nicene emperor since 375, but Valentian was no longer the emperor. In 375 in the West, the Nicene emperor was Gratian. And he appointed a new Nicene emperor then in the East when Valens died in 378. And the one he appointed in the East then was a Spanish soldier called Theodosius. And we've looked at him, Theodosius the Great. Remember, he had his battles with Ambrose of Milan. Remember? With church-state relations. Where Ambrose would withhold communion from him unless he repented of certain things. And then you had the church controlling the state. Okay. Up until this point, it's just nothing but the state controlling the church pretty much. But then with Ambrose of Milan, you have him starting using the church and fencing the table from Theodosius for communion. But it was Theodosius then, his passion was to bring Christianity to the empire. And he gave Arianism a death blow, is the way Nick Needham describes it, by issuing an edict in 380 AD that said Nicene believers were the only ones legally entitled to use the name Catholic. Remember, the name for anyone before that time is Catholic. If we'd existed at that time and been Christian, we'd have been part of the Catholic Church. Catholic. We don't refer to the Roman Catholics until the Protestant Reformation in the 1500s. But he, in that edict in 380, Emperor Theodosius said that Nicene believers were the only ones who were legally entitled to use the name Catholic, which gave the Nicenes then legal possession of all church building, all church property. Since the Nicenes then were only allowed to be the ones allowed legally to use the word Catholic, then who gets the Catholic building? The Nicene. That's some shrewdness there. Innocent as dove, but shrewd as a serpent there on that one. Well, in 381, a year after that edict, Theodosius, the emperor, called an ecumenical council at Constantinople. Remember, there was at least 300 bishops at Nicene in 325. That was the first ecumenical council called there in 325 by Constantine. So the second ecumenical council is called by Theodosius as emperor in 381. Ecumenical means of the known world at that time, meaning of the entire Roman Empire. And then they produced, at the Council of Constantinople in 381, they produced a new revised form of the Nicene Creed, including the ideas of the Cappadocians and how the wording was used then. Of three hypostases in one ousia. Three persons in one essence. And we're more explicit on the Holy Spirit and the divinity of the Holy Spirit. So that's basically a revision of the Nicene Creed. So we refer to the Nicene Creed of 325 as revised by the Council of Constantinople in 381. And that's what we ascribe to as the Nicene Creed. As revised in 381 at the Council of Constantinople. And it was used regularly in worship in Eastern Catholic churches by the end of the 5th century AD, and it was used regularly by the end of the 6th century AD in the West in worship. I have a creed, confession. This is what the Bible states and who God reveals himself to be. Three persons existing eternally in one single essence. So, Lord willing, the next time we meet, we're going to get into particular theologians of this time period. Late 300s going into the early 400s. Lord willing, that's where we'll pick up the story.